If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Give your phone by it or anything?
Hey, my friend. Gary Jenkins here.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. How you doing?
Facebook Living right now, so people are going to be able to hear him on the stream as well as we're talking. Just be aware of that.
Right. Right, now, we'll be aware of that. We won't launch into anything about where he is. Or the only thing we'll say is this is a former corrections officer from the United States prison at Merriam, maximum security prison. We're going to talk with him about what happened to Whitey Bulger. Everybody knows that Whitey Bulger got killed, so we're just kind of curious, my friend, curious about kind of the intake procedures. I don't know if you followed the news. Have you seen it? Anything in the details on it on the news?
I've seen some things where he was beaten to the point where his eyeballs fell out and wheeled over in the corner and worked over off camera. That sort of thing is what I've seen.
Oh, so they worked
and
him over.
He was only there like 12 hours before the attack. That's all I've.
Yeah, he just got to. So somebody like Whitey Bulger, he's been in a more like a snitch prison, I think, in a nicer place. And I believe he got in trouble. It was some kind of a sex thing. That old guy was 80-some years old, and he gets in trouble for some kind of sexual activity. I could not figure out what it is.
In prison?
In prison, yeah.
Well, you know, probably involved either a guard or an inmate.
Well, I don't think it was with another person. Now, would that be right? If you caught somebody with just whacking off or whatever he was doing?
Yeah, mostly what they do is they expose themselves to the female staff.
That's, oh.
That would be, if I was to guess at anything, that's what my guess would
all
be.
All right, all
well,
right.
But that would be behind the glass, wouldn't it? You know, they'd be on the other side of the bars or a plexiglass window, wouldn't they, at the time? Like you're in a central kind of a, you know, an area where they can see you because there's cameras everywhere. So all they'd have to do is be like in a hallway or somewhere going, no, 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 you know.
Yeah, but everybody that's been in any place for any amount of time, we know where the dead spots are. And I'm sure that the inmates are educated rather quickly as to where the spots are that you can do something and not be observed. And if you're in your cell, just assuming for a moment, if you're in your cell, we don't usually put a camera on your cell unless, you know, you're a suicide risk or something.
Oh, right, like directly inside the cell. So he must have done something like that anyhow. And it's like, you know, in my opinion, I know a little bit about, you know, the government and dealing with people like Whitey Bulger who are maybe people who constantly defy your authority and are looking to cut an edge all the time, and sometimes you get, and you've been taking care of him, and they sent him to this Hazleton, this USP, a U.S. prison at Hazleton in West Virginia, and everything I've been able to find out about that prison, that's one bad place. That's like a gladiator school more so than...
Really, because I thought Coleman was. That's where we've had, you know, several murders and...
I'm saying he has a microphone on that tablet. This by that microphone, he's going to hear you and me.
Okay, all right. Okay. Does that make sense? We're going to try another test here with our, see if you can hear Aaron.
See if that's any better. I'm here. 1, 2, 3.
Could you hear Aaron?
Well, I can hear you better now.
Yeah,
all
yeah,
right. That's, okay,
we can kind of do the same thing we did on the Facebook Live with a headphone. And so that way we can, let me put that back.
Well,
interestingly enough, you know, Gary talks about the particular prison that they sent Whitey Bulger to. Where do they keep him before they decide what prison to send him to?
Oh,
I mean, Gary says snitch prison.
Well, say if he was coming to Marion, we would just ship him to Marion, and then he would be in, special housing, which would be an individual cell, and he wouldn't be able to be touched by any other inmates. And then once we decide where to put him, then he would go from from that location to wherever it is we put him.
Yeah, and that would be so within the prison. But before he came to Marion, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Before he came to Marion, he was in what might be described as a snitch prison, and I know they have them where they will keep people who are high-profile informants. How does that work? Do you have any experience with those operations, or do you know anything about those?
Absolutely, Marion had a lot of that.
What do you have a special?
Is that what they called it, the snitch prison?
No, well, you might call it that way. Colloquially, but otherwise they're not going to identify it officially as anything. It's just another prison, officially.
So if we looked it up, we wouldn't be able to know which prison was that prison because they just give it a name like Marion.
Right. Yeah, it'd be Marion, Coleman, something like that.
But everybody who is actually in the prison, somehow they seem to know which prison is the snitch prison.
Well, you only do 50% of anything. So say you're going to have, like Marion right now, today, this very moment, they're designated for sexual offenders. But only 50% of the population is a sexual offender. That way, when you're transferred out of Marion, you don't have that stigma attached to you because only 50% of the population falls into that category. So that way they can cover it up.
So there's like a 50-50 chance that Whitey Bulger or somebody else would have shown up. They were never sure. I mean, because that was kind of my question. Like Gary said, the prison system has its own grapevine that folks maybe actually knew that Whitey was coming to the prison that he ended up at.
They may have known that he was coming there, but they wouldn't have known the exact time that he was coming there. That's a possibility. Also, since he's such a high-profile inmate, they all knew that he was a cooperating witness. Well, that wasn't going to be a secret, ever.
Yeah. But, I mean, so in your experience, if you weren't even on the, I mean, if you were on the watch, but it wasn't maybe your cell or your section, I mean, would they give you information about these kind of prison transfers if it wasn't related to you doing that duty specifically? Or you guys would be like in the break room going, you can't believe who's coming in.
No, I probably wouldn't hear that. I would hear as he hit the door, but not prior.
So like a prison like a big prison like Merriam or like this Hazleton or any of the prisons, how much trafficking in and out between prisons is there on a daily basis? Is there a lot, or is it unusual to have somebody transfer in from another prison?
No, there's a regular bus that's all they do, and they have a route, and they transfer prisoners routinely. It's not unusual at all for a prisoner doing life in prison to have been at 5 or 6 penitentiaries in his career.
Interesting. I've heard it said that sometimes there's a little unofficial discipline placed on certain prisoners who have become a thorn in the side of the guards or the officers, and they'll just put them on this route. They'll put them on a bus. As soon as they get settled in one prison, they'll ship them to another one. As soon as they get settled in there, they'll ship them to another one for a while. Have you ever heard any stories like that?
Officially, that never happened. We call it diesel therapy.
Diesel, that's it. I heard that term before, and I couldn't think of it. Diesel therapy.
Is that a technical term?
Yes, that is.
It's exactly what you said. As soon as you get settled in, as soon as your mail catches up with you and your property catches up with you, you're put on a bus and set somewhere else, and your mail and property got to catch up with you again. And after a while, somebody's going to get sick of it, and somebody's going to give up. So either him or us. And
you got a lot
I
of buses.
Care less. I'll see you every other month.
Yeah.
Here's a question for you. When it comes to that kind of thing, do you happen to have a bunny costume and a leather carrot that if you know you're going to have to talk to somebody, but you don't want them to know that it's you? Gary and I were talking about, if you watch the Facebook Live from yesterday, he had a great story about when they might happen to, in the old days of the police department, they'd leave a guy in a questioning room alone for a while, and then some guy showed up in a bunny costume.
And whack him on the head with a carrot.
The bet was made of lead.
And it was made at, that had a slapper on the inside
slapper.
Of it. I mean, who would believe the dude? Who would believe him? You know, hey, you can't believe this, tell his lawyer. So, you know, a six-foot-tall bunny hopped in my room and hit me in the head with his carrot and knocked me off the chair. And nobody would ever believe him, would they?
No, they certainly wouldn't.
But they, you know, all the guards would want to sit around and watch the rollback on that video.
that would not be on video, and that would be in a dead spot.
Right.
that was the bad old days. That was before my time, and I'm sure it was before your time too. The modern law enforcement and corrections officers and everybody are much more professional
yeah.
than that.
Yeah. Now they do waterboarding.
That's only in Guantanamo and the Chicago PD.
The Bureau of Prisons don't do waterboarding.
No, they don't call it waterboarding.
Where I worked at, we had an officer prosecuted because he slapped an inmate and kneed him in the groin, and he ended up getting convicted of a felony.
Oh, wow.
Did 6 months home confinement. You know, really, it was a lot of consequences for him.
That's got to be a hard job. I mean, when you think about it, these guys, they're just always there trying to egg you on. You know, because they know you put a hand on them and they got a case on you pretty much. Because it's not really that it's outside the law, but if they touch you first, that's different.
Yeah, and even then, it's like when you're a cop, you can fire back, but when he's down and doesn't appear to be a threat, you can't empty the revolver into him. So it's the same with us. You know, once I gain control of the inmate, I can't continually beat on him. And but of course, they always claim that that's what we did.
Yeah. Only the force necessary to control the situation. I understand that.
Well, Whitey Bulger apparently didn't have the force to control the situation.
No.
85-year-old guy, he was a tough guy. And here's, who is it? Can we talk a little bit about that guy that did the, that killed him? Because yeah, obviously, guy's got his bones now.
He was a young mobster, Fortios Freddy Gias, G-E-A-S. He was a West Springfield, Massachusetts Navy native. He was serving life in prison for another murder. And, you know, what's interesting about him, why he hated informants so much, two people, he murdered a guy, or he set up a guy and paid another guy to go do the murder. And they got caught, and two people testified in him. The mob boss, Adolfo Bruno, testified against Gias for setting up that murder, but he's the one that ordered the murder. And then the guy who did the murder testified against Gias. So he had snitches on both sides. He's the only one that paid the price. You know, these guys, the feds, you know, they'll get, how many murders did they give up for Sammy the Bull Gravano? Like 30-some, maybe 20. He was like a serial killer. He'd killed 25 or 30 guys, and they put him in witness protection. Hell, our good friend Frank Culotta had, you know, flat admitted to one murder and told him all the details, and he walked on that. So this guy was paying the price because of two informants, so he did not like informants anyhow.
You know, and speaking of that, you get a life sentence, and you basically got a free ticket. You can continuously murder people, to include the staff, and all they're going to usually give you, in most cases, is another life sentence. So yeah. It doesn't matter. The last two officers that were killed in the Bureau of Prisons, their murderers got another life sentence, which doesn't add 10 minutes to their time.
It doesn't. The best you can do is put them in solitary confinement, and they're that crazy, they were probably going to be there anyhow.
Yeah, and usually there's really no solitary confinement. I know people say there's a no human contact orders and that kind of thing, and that's really not true. A no human contact order. It means unfettered. So, like the two murders that took place at Marion, the guy had handcuffs on. He released himself from handcuffs, obtained a weapon from a co-conspirator. That when he got out of the cuffs, he reaches over and a guy hands him a knife, and then he goes to stabbing the officer. Now, he had a no contact order. But it doesn't mean that you're never in a room with another human being. It just means you're never unfettered. But if he can release himself, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, he can still murder you.
Really? You know, and in the federal system particularly, there's it's really limited in under federal statutes on homicide. I would think if it was in a state where they had the death penalty, even though it happened in a federal facility to a federal officer, I would think the state could then take jurisdiction over that and charge him under charge the inmate under state law. But maybe they just by protocol do not ever do that.
No, there's a legal fiction. And the legal fiction is that say in Marion, I know that this occurs there. We're in a special federal or maritime jurisdiction, and we're not actually in part of the state of Illinois for legal purposes. So the state of Illinois actually doesn't have jurisdiction over what happens in Marion. It's exclusively federal.
Well, interesting.
And most federal prisons are that way, but not all. Some have concurrent jurisdiction.
I'd say that again. So they either have concurrent jurisdiction or what was the term you're saying for Marion?
Exclusive federal.
Exclusive
the
federal.
The reason it is, it's in a legal fiction area, which means it's exclusively federal or maritime. And that's the way they call it, exclusively federal or maritime. So if you look up the rule of the law, that's the way it will come out.
Huh. Yeah, you're not in, Marion's not even close to an ocean.
Yeah, really.
How many ships you got coming into port?
It's treated as if it was in our 200-mile limit.
I'll be darned.
For legal purposes.
Wait, 200-mile limit? How big an exclusion area do they have? I mean, if you walked into the prison yourself and something happened, you're under the jurisdiction of the federal government now, not the state, even yourself.
Correct. So the guy that I'm talking about that assaulted a federal inmate on federal ground, the state couldn't prosecute him. Only the feds could, and of course they did.
Interesting. I'll be darned. I did not know that.
Well, so is anybody, you know, since they already know who this guy is that killed James Whitey Bulger, that I'm guessing he's now in solitary. He's in, you know, cordoned off from the rest of the general population because, you know, Whitey had his own gang going and, you know, the prison's infiltrated there with these guys. And somebody's going to take this guy down like he took Whitey down.
It's possible, and yes, he would be immediately quarantined from the rest of the population. You know, this whole incident is a giant screw-up. I would really hate to be this warden, because he's going to be in a hot seat over this.
That was a question I was going to ask on that, because it just seemed like Whitey was such a high-profile guy, and there's so much known about him that he comes into this prison and is all of a sudden at the mercy of kind of a shot caller. Actually, this kid was a shot caller in his area. He was, of course, he wasn't black, so he wouldn't have called the shots with the blacks. I understand in that penitentiary there's two or three different divisions in that penitentiary, and this guy in his particular area was probably as professional criminals and mob associates and actual mob people. He was a shot caller, and all of a sudden this guy Whitey is alone. They're able to get to him real quickly after he got there. I was wondering about that.
Less than 12 hours?
Yeah.
Yeah, normally what we do is we have a list. Like, say this Whitey would come into my institution. I would know who we're supposed to keep him apart from. It's formalized. I mean, there's a formal list of groups or individuals that he's to be separated from. And I'm assuming, at least from my old vantage point, that we kept mobsters apart. We didn't want them to congregate together for reasons like this, or that they would cause us problems. And that's why I'm saying that this warden is he's really in the hot seat, because, like, he had mob and mob associates in the same room, and it's like, wow, what a screw up.
Yeah, and it's so uncontrolled that they can do what they did. It is kind of a black eye on the federal prison system, that's for sure.
Well, so then it kind of lends itself to ask the question, maybe there was a little inside help to allow that to happen.
And they,
this has been done at least one time before what you're talking about. At the ADX.
What's ADX?
It was 1999. There was an individual. His name was Joseph Principe. And he was released in 2008 for this, by the way. But it was alleged that he conspired with the Aryan Brotherhood to put individuals on the yard at the same time so that someone could be assassinated. And he was convicted and sentenced to prison for it. So it has happened in the past.
It's not out of the realm of possibility. I mean, anytime you've got, you know, law enforcement or a large group of people that are doing this kind of work, whether it be the cop on the beat or the detective or correctional officers, you know, you're going to have some people, you're going to have some bad apples. There's no doubt about it, that can be bought off. Now, on the internet, they're already starting the rumors that it was, Whitey Bulger could damage Bob Mueller because Mueller was the head of the FBI over the guy that the FBI agent that went to jail for taking bribes from Whitey and the one that warned him off. So, you know, this will continue to grow, I'm sure, the conspiracy theories around Whitey Bulger, because it's blasting out all over the place on in the news and on the different media outlets, especially social media. Oh, we had another question.
What is, you said that, well, the ADX?
Normally I'd tell you that was complete crap and it couldn't possibly happen, but I know of at least one instance for sure that it happened. So it's not entirely out of the realm of possibility.
What does ADX stand for?
It's administrative...
I feel your pain here. It's something you used all your life, and you once knew it one time, but now it became the ADX.
The ADX.
Administrative detention, yeah. Something probably.
Exchange.
It does stand for administrative something.
Sorry, I didn't mean to put you on the spot there, sir. Gary, he brought it back around because we kind of delved into the, continued the question, and I was curious. A lot of times you use these little, you know, three-letter acronyms, and people don't know what they are. And so, you know, in law enforcement and the general public may not understand that. So I'm kind of John Q. Public here to say, wait a second, I know what a PDQ is, but I don't know an ADX. I was almost, and then when he's talking about the conspiracies and, you know, and Mueller, I'm like, oh, man, I'm just going to... I'm waiting for Donald Trump to have a tweet out about this.
Really?
That's what I'm saying.
I know. I can't believe.
I know Whitey very well.
I can't believe the president had tweeted about this.
If we want to talk about conspiracies and how it could relate to this guy, there was another incident that happened right there at Coleman in 2005. A lady named Erin Sharma, she married an Indian guy, so that's why her last name is Sharma. She was... she had a confrontation with an inmate, and he grabbed her through the food slot and yanked her arm into the cell, and it upset her greatly.
Yeah, I bet.
And so she told a member of the Aryan Brotherhood that it would be really nice if somebody broke this guy's leg. And 3 days later, he was put into the cell, and she's claimed to have orchestrated that transfer. He was put into the cell with the same guy. And he got his head bashed in, and he died 3 days after that. She was convicted of murder. She's the only correctional officer that's ever been sentenced to life in prison for something that she did at work.
Wow.
That was right there at Coleman.
Yeah. That's a heck of a story. See, that is a tough place. That's what this article I read said. It was a really tough place.
So, you know, if folks go out there, they might listen to an interview that we did with a gentleman who's got a YouTube channel called As the Key Turns, and talks about a great story about John Gotti, and when John Gotti was assaulted, and but has a better story about how John Gotti bought an expensive piece of food from one of the vending machines in Marion, and asked this guard to heat it up for him. So no charges were filed in that, were they?
God, he wanted to file civil charges against you, didn't he? You burned his dinner. You cost him $5.
Yeah. I always say I whacked his dinner.
You whacked his
you
dinner.
You whacked his, yes,
that
right.
That was a good one.
If Whitey Bulger had a meal, you would have microwaved it just as well. Now, Whitey, unfortunately, yeah. I'm kind of curious, and maybe folks watching may ask questions if Gary can see in the chat, the live chat.
Any.
There's some folks watching us live, and maybe if they have a question, we can convey that to you as well. But my question was, so this happens. Whitey's dead. His body literally just laying there as then, you know, the call goes out like, you know, this is not a man down emergency. Is it? Do they, like, come running like when you came through the door when John Gotti was assaulted?
Yeah, absolutely. Somebody will dial deuces, that's what we call it. You hit 222 on the phone, the alarm goes out, and until he's officially declared dead, he is not dead. And if your head, half of it was missing, they're supposed to give you life-saving, you know, they're supposed to give you CPR and the whole thing, like they think that you're still alive, even though we are all looking at him going, he's dead as a doornail. It doesn't matter. They attempt to resuscitate you.
And then what, I mean, so at that point, it's a crime scene, and they have to, you know, kind of isolate the area, and here's this corpse laying there, eyes popped out, is what you're telling us, what the news is reporting. You're a correctional officer, not a janitor, right? Who cleans that up?
First of all, you're going to process the crime scene, and it depends on if the FBI wants it or not. Probably in this case, they would.
Right.
So we got our own investigators. They'll come down and secure the crime scene. They'll probably start taking photographs. The FBI will eventually show up and take whatever samples that they want. I've seen them unscrew doorknobs and take it with them because it had a bloody fingerprint on it. After the crime scene is processed for evidence, we usually have a team of inmates that come in and actually clean up the blood and whatever. And then half an hour after the blood's all cleaned up, we go back to normal.
Yeah, interesting. So how would the investigation proceed on this in regards to the suspect and who was helping him? Because I understand there was more than one person that went into that cell. How would that proceed? How would the investigation proceed once the crime scene was secure, and then you've got two or three suspects? I understand they go start pulling camera footage, I'm sure, to find out who was in the area, who was in. How would that proceed?
They apprehend them the same as you would on the street. You just you go out and you snag up you know, Joe and Bill, put them in handcuffs, and take them to, well, it'd be like going to jail. You take them to special housing, lodge them there while the investigation goes on. And after that, it's just like regular police work, collecting evidence, statements, footage from any cameras, on and on.
One thing about it, you wouldn't have to get a search warrant to search their housing area, would you?
No, the only thing that we might need a search warrant for is to get a blood sample.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Unless he volunteers.
Interesting. Or a DNA sample. Of course, they've already got their DNA. Everybody in Missouri that gets busted, takes a cops a plea, even a suspended imposition of sentence for a felony, will give a DNA sample to go in the DNA bank.
Yes, yeah. So we've already got that. The only thing I've ever heard of them getting a warrant for was a blood sample.
Man, but yeah, cleanup crew—they got a lot of blood sample.
Yeah,
there's some murderabilia for you. The rags from the crew. I mean, these are the guys that I can't imagine they're in the prison who'd want to go in and clean that up. You must get, you know, how much do they pay these guys to work in the prison? 8 to 10 cents an hour? Like, you have a choice. You could work in the cafeteria or clean up the body of Whitey Bulger. I'm like, I think I'll take the cafeteria.
Really?
What's on the menu today? Oh, great. Meatloaf again.
they tried to task us with the cleanup. And, you know, we got sick, and my foot hurt, and I got something else to do, and we'll get to it right away, boss, right. And it just never happened.
Somebody dials 222, and you're all somewhere else.
Stuff. Yeah. That's what we call the blue flu there. y'all got the blue flu on that one day when it was time to clean up the bloody mess from some prisoner stabbing the other.
That's exactly what happened. Yeah.
The blue flu.
Well, this is quite a deal. Whitey Herzog. I can't get Whitey Herzog out of my head when I say Whitey. I mean, Whitey Herzog was a first baseman for the Cardinals when I was a kid, and I had a Whitey Herzog autographed first baseman's mitt, and then he came here to the Royals and beat St. Louis in the World Series. So, but Whitey Bulger, that's why I just cannot get, when I say Whitey, I want to say Herzog. Those of you older people or baseball fans too. All right, well, I don't know. You got any more questions, Aaron?
Anybody in the chat room? You see anybody's got a question?
Everybody in the chat room, they all seem to agree pretty much among the mob fans that Whitey was a rat, to quote him, and he got what he deserved. The mob never forgets and all that kind of stuff. I'm not sure about the mob never forgets. I know a lot of people that are out here.
Yeah.
Frank Calabrese is running a mob tour up in Chicago, and Nick, his uncle Nick, I looked him up. Nick Calabrese is out and about. But he's laying low. I think he's still in witness
interview.
Protection. Yeah, really. Maybe we can get his nephew to get him for us.
But Frank, you know, that's the shocking thing about this whole incident is that it was well known that he was a cooperating witness. Even people on the street know the mob doesn't forget.
Yeah.
And then they still put him out in a room that had mob associates and members. It was like, wow, did somebody make this horrendous screw up, or was there somebody that just opened a door that wasn't supposed to be opened?
Yeah.
Was it somebody's first day on the job? I'm just guessing, because otherwise you think if you've been there a while, you would know these things. These are kind of laid out facts that, like you say, they would know to keep them separated from specific people.
Really? Now, correct me if I'm wrong. Whitey, and I've heard of this, where somebody's in protective custody and they ask to go back into general population because it's too boring and they think they're going to be okay in general population. They can handle it. If Whitey had gone in there and he'd have said, you know, I do not want protective custody, just put me in Gen Pop, then they would just put him in. Would that be correct?
No. This guy, the one that I was talking about, the correctional officer, almost all of them are in protective custody. He said that he didn't want protective custody. They kept him in it involuntarily for a while, but eventually he was able to convince them that he could get along in general pop, and they did. But it's not entirely up to the inmate to make that decision.
Okay.
Somebody had to agree that yes, he was perfectly safe, and then allow it. So just because he says he wants to be in general pop, they may not do it. It still falls back onto the staff. It was a staff screw-up to put him in general population, so, knowing what we know.
So I guess if I think about it, like even when a local police department puts somebody in their overnight holding facility, you're totally responsible for their safety and have to use your best judgment, no matter what they may say they want to do. What, you know, like if you got a guy that gets in a fight in a tank and you take him out and put him in another cell and he says, oh, I'm okay. You know, and your judgment is that, no, he's not going to be okay. You keep him out, so you're responsible as a correctional officer for that person's safety and security, no matter, you know, even though they have bad judgment, you still are responsible.
Absolutely, yeah.
Interesting. I never thought about it like that.
Care and custody.
Care and custody.
They call it care and custody. I'm responsible for his care and his custody.
Okay.
Same as if he's direly ill. I have to make sure that he gets, you know, the proper medical treatment. If I go by a cell and there's a guy in there bleeding to death or deathly ill, and I don't say anything about it, it falls back on me.
Yeah.
Same way with if I know an inmate is going to get his head smashed in if I put him into cell number 4, and they tell me to put him in cell 4, I have to refuse. I know it's going to happen. The guy in there just said he's going to smash his head.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, we've gotten in trouble a few times because people will cry sick when they're not really sick because they can get sent to the hospital maybe, and then it's easier to maybe get away. And then they really were sick, and the people didn't believe them, and then something develops that is a lot worse. I know our police department's been sued several times successfully for for that. But there's so many times that people, you know, lie so they can get out the hospital and spend several hours out at the hospital and maybe get away, or at least have a little more comfortable overnight stay, and then they can make the bond in the morning.
Well, there's a lot more nurses to expose yourself to if you're Whitey Bulger.
Yeah, and we've had inmates in the past somehow fake symptoms or something to go to the hospital, and it's all prearranged and escape.
Yeah.
So when they arrive, half the people in the emergency room is cohort. So yes, we've had that happen too.
You know, after talking with you at length, and then talking with our friend Martin J. McNally, I realize it's a constant battle of the wits between a lot of the prisoners and a lot of the correctional officers. Would you characterize it as a constant battle of the wits?
Yes, and Martin McNally was just one of the outstanding examples.
He was a good example of that. I tried to go see him the other day. I was down in St. Louis, and I couldn't get in touch with him in time. But
he was probably busy going out to Oregon, you know, Washington, to dig up his D.B. Cooper money.
Dig up his D.B. Cooper money.
Yeah, you know, but that's another story.
Oh, and you'll be interested to know this. I think he's got a movie deal finally. He had one on for a documentary, and it fell through. But then another guy got hold of him, and I think maybe they're working on something right now. I think that will be a hell of an interesting film. I'd like to see it done, because it's such a great story.
I'd actually pay the ticket to go see it. It would be an interesting movie.
I would too, but I wonder when to be able to sit next to Martin.
Yeah.
In case somebody hijacked the movie.
Came in and held on, put a gun on everybody, and then demanded $500,000.
That's right, and he's going to jump out the exit door at the behind the screen if we don't give him into his demands.
That'll be Mike's last big caper, huh?
At the movie premiere.
Yeah. All right, Aaron, you have something?
Yeah, I was kind of curious because obviously there's cameras all over the prison. Maybe I don't know if we covered this earlier, but there's tape out there. I mean, there's tape of him coming in. There's tape of him going into the cell. All that tape of the guys. Is that going to go? They must have to put that somewhere for the record to go, like, if they're going to convict the guy that did it. Right?
Yes, it should be introduced as evidence. So eventually, it should become a public record.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, only if they present it as an exhibit at trial. If it is shown to the public as an exhibited trial, then it can. If there's audio in it, then it can only then can it be released as to the public. But yeah, lots of times you see these things that get released out there. I don't know. They also get sent, if he gets a lawyer, then the lawyer will get copies of all that audio and video. And then the lawyer could end up releasing it back out to the public. But the government, it's a little harder to get it from.
Well, the government wouldn't write a book and make a movie where the lawyer might.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Lawyer want to sell it to somebody.
Well, talking about that, the fight that I was involved with, when John Gotti was assaulted, I attempted to get a hold of that video and was unable to. They now claim it's all been destroyed.
Yeah. That's too bad. That'd have been a nice, valuable little tidbit of video. What you should have done, you should have filed a lawsuit against somebody and then used the court system to get some subpoena power to get it from them. Then you could have got it. Kind of a laborious way to do it, but that would been a way to do it.
Is it part of, like, discovery then?
Yeah, anytime you got discovery, then you get the civil court to go in and subpoena the evidence and... somebody may fight you for it, but at least you got a chance of getting a judge to order it and being released.
Well, and then once you file a civil suit, I know the feds won't release it under Freedom of Information Act. That's kind of their thing, too.
Right. The Freedom of Information Act's one thing, but you can get stuff if you're involved, if it's some evidence that's needed for a civil suit. Now, sometimes then, though, if they really fight you and you have a good reason for it, then they get it, but they'll keep it under a gag order where it can only be used, what they call in camera, to the judge or to the jury, and it still can't be shown to the public. So there's many ways around it. Sometimes you just get a good friendly guard that happens to snag a copy of it, and then you can get it.
And it ends up on the internet.
Ends up in the TMZ news, and those people have their fingers out there all the time, and they got money. Well, maybe it'll appear.
I have seen some stuff that's on the news or in some public arena that I'm like, wow, how did that get released?
Yeah, really.
They knew an email address like ganglandwire@gmail.com.
Yeah.
And we can take that file, 25, we'll give you a load-up space if you need to share the file and the video because it's too big to send as a 25-megabyte email. I just send an email and we'll get that video up for you.
Yeah, well, I tell you what, the video of Whitey, what happened to Whitey would be very, very valuable. That'd be six figures there, right there, buddy.
Yeah, we can't pay you for it. I'm not saying that. But I'm just saying if you wanted to get it out there and you didn't want to be on TMZ, you wanted a little credibility, I think Gangland Wire's got it.
All right.
Someone's got to break the news. Why not us? So here, and a last question. Ben Ellickson chatting in saying they should premiere the movie of Martin McNally on an airplane. That would be a great in-flight movie unless you're flying from St. Louis to Tulsa.
On a 727, on American Airlines 727.
Yeah, I tagged American Airlines repeatedly on Twitter as we had released some of this stuff, and then they stopped blocking my tags. Or they started blocking my tags.
They didn't want to hear about it.
They did not want to hear about this. And there's more of this going to be told, probably. But my question is this. Chat room chat aside, now that Whitey's expired and there's a process to get, you know, they're not going to keep this body in the prison. He's going to have to be, sent to, he's in a morgue or somewhere after they do ever their autopsy. And then, how do they do that with the body where there's like, who's going to come forward to claim Whitey's, body? And then they'd have a funeral somewhere.
Yeah, that's an easy one. His closest relative is the custodian of the body, and then they can dispose of it as if you drop dead. You know, your wife or parents have the responsibility to dispose of you. Same with him, no different.
Probably he has family, his Irish family up there in Boston. It's probably extended family. Somebody will probably get it. What happens if nobody shows up to claim the body?
Oh, they could turn them over to the county, and they're disposed of as a pauper. That's happened at Marion.
Okay, that's what I figured. There'd be many times that would happen.
And so they have like a cemetery somewhere off to the side in Marion.
No, what they did at Marion is they turn them over as a pauper. They're embalmed to give someone practice embalming, and then they're cremated. And somebody in the county is storing a bunch of these urns for a certain amount of time, and I don't remember what the criteria was. But after that, they throw you away.
Yeah, I saw a documentary about L.A. County. They get hundreds of those kinds of unclaimed bodies every year in the process that they go through. And they, like you said, they put them in these urns and the cremated returns, and they keep them for a certain period of time, and then they just take them out and throw them away.
There's a statute of limitations on how long they're required to keep the remains of these people that are paupers, be they a prison inmate in the case of somebody, say, like Whitey Bulger or me,
yeah,
right? And so when my family doesn't claim my body and Gary lets me go to the go to the warehouse,
yeah,
6 years later, you and I can't dispose of our own family members' remains, even though they're cremated any time. Right, that's what I understand.
Yeah, I don't know.
You have to like put them in the ocean. That's the only thing you can do, I thought. But here's a company that's just warehousing people's remains.
It's not a company; it's the county.
Or the county, and then there's some guy in a warehouse it's the end of the month. It's the 1st of November. Or who's leaving today?
Yeah.
And they wheel them out and just put them in a dumpster.
Yeah, pretty much. That's what they were doing out in L.A. County. They did have a place. They dug a hole and poured them in, and then covered it up. So it's a little more genteel than putting them in a dumpster.
That's how you get rid of a pet.
Yeah, really. All right. I think we've probably covered the waterfront on this subject. We really appreciate you calling in. And
do we want to give them a plug?
And informing our listeners and Gangland Wire, your insight information on the prison system and how that might have worked in the Whitey Bulger case. We're going to talk about your And I tell you, folks out there, you need to go to the YouTube video channel, As the Key Turns. It's got our friend on there, and he's got some of the daggone stories you ever heard. Writers, I just had a writer friend of mine I was talking to, and I said, if you're looking for content, you want some kind of stories about how life was like in a penitentiary, you need to go and listen to watch some of these videos, because it's unbelievable. I mean, you can't write some of this stuff, and it's all true. It's all true, isn't it?
Yeah, that was the thing about it. Even I scratch my head and go, man, if somebody told me this, I wouldn't believe it.
Well, if there's somebody that, I'm surprised maybe no one's reached out to you to get comment for all of this happening, and because we had the opportunity to interview you before, and if you go back to ganglandwire.com, you'll be able to find, I think it's probably, keyword search.
Keyword search, John Gotti and Martin McNally, and you'll find those interviews.
A couple of interviews that we've done with this gentleman, which are great. And again, one of these, much like I'm doing this as a Facebook Live, where from the mouth of the men that did it, here's a guy who worked at a supermax prison and would have the experience day to day. For how many years did you work there?
23 years.
23 years. More. Bringing these guys like this in and out of a supermax prison. So thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us, and definitely all those wiretappers out there watching, we're recording, we'll share this audio, and we want you to go out and like, share, and subscribe the YouTube channel As the Key Turns.
Share some of those videos with some of your other mob fan buddies, because he's got some true crime friends, because he's got some great pieces of video out there. All right, we will say goodbye now.
All right, thank you very much.
Talk to you later. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bring the phone line down there. And.
All right, give us a little insight into what that would be like to be inside one of those penitentiaries where something like that could happen to somebody.
Yeah, you have to imagine that Whitey had to have kind of known that he had to be on his guard.
Yeah, but you know, you can only be on your guard so much when you're 80-some years old and in a wheelchair, and you got a bunch of young guys.
Was he in a wheelchair when it happened?
Yeah, that's what I read. He was
really?
In a wheelchair.
I didn't catch. See, I worked overnight all night at Chubby's on Broadway, and they closed up, and the news was there, and which was a great local family restaurant for like 40 years that was the namesake. Chubby is a local gentleman that Gary knows by the name of
Jimmy DiCapo.
Jimmy DiCapo, who may or may not have, who did serve time.
All right. You got anything else on that, Aaron?
I'm looking in the chat. Do you see anything? Anybody else?
I don't see anything. Sam Dawson was on there for a little bit.
I saw that, yeah. Ben Ellickson as well.
Ben, and
I sent an invite, Nick Stubbs to come over and see if he wanted to check out that live Facebook event we were doing.
And there's Anthony Baguglia, and I think the guy from On the Spot, and all of a sudden I forgot his name, that came out to the Mob World Summit.
God, Rick Amaretto.
No, Rick was on there earlier. No, that's a Kansas City guy that has that Save the Union Station, John Lazia exhibit Facebook page. He's a big mob fan. He came to our first live podcast. And, I'm sorry, I cannot remember his name all of a sudden. Maybe somebody's put something up.
I was looking here because Jay had a couple pages of notes on this, and so we kind of spitballed the interview there with our friend from As the Key Turns. But here then I flip over the pages to see what else question-wise or fact-wise that we may have may or may not have covered. And he had some Whitey Bulger facts here. I really should have got the bifocals. I just didn't want to look old. Here it says Whitey Bulger facts. He was one of the FBI's top 10 most wanted list, sitting at, you guessed it, number 2. Who was number 1?
He must have been a bad dude.
Right? If you're worse than Whitey
Bulger. I don't know who number 1 was.
His son, he had a son who died in 1973 from Reye's syndrome at the age of 6. I did not know that.
I didn't either. Probably nobody else knows it either.
Throughout his career, it is estimated he made over $25 million. I bet he probably made more than that. He served time in the military jail for assault. And here's another fact. In June 1956, he was sentenced to 25 years in federal prison. He ended up serving 9 years, including stints in Atlanta, Alcatraz, and here in our hometown around Kansas City at Leavenworth.
So he knew the prison system. He was, this was not his first dance at the rodeo and being in a federal prison. He'd been in Alcatraz, Leavenworth, and Atlanta. All three of them are high security prisons.
And he probably wasn't in a wheelchair in 56.
He was probably a lot tougher then. He was probably he was the one that was going around killing snitches back then.
He was probably saying, "I'll just go ahead and go into Gen Pop." Like really? That's a whole new like hashtag we're gonna have to use.
He would run
hashtag Gen Pop.
He'd be a shot caller. Whitey Herzog. I still go in that Whitey Herzog route. Whitey Bulger would have been what they call a shot caller in the penitentiary system.
If you've got questions, if you've got suggestions maybe for an episode, if you have information that that might be helpful,
send it to us.
Give us an email.
We'll take a look.
ganglandwire@gmail.com or info@ganglandwire.com. And we'll, you know, tell us you love the show. We might read one of your emails on the program.
Or message me through the Facebook messaging function or Twitter.
What about that public service announcement, Gary?
Yeah. Have you got a friend or relative has a problem with drugs or alcohol? Make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900. Or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I've got to say, folks, you need to get the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available for rental on Amazon, or you can buy the streaming copy, but you know what that doesn't have? The DVD extras. You need to give us a donation of $25 or more if you live in the United States, and Gary has a few copies left. He might even take one or two of mine to send you, and he will autograph it himself. The documentary Gangland Wire that started it all inspired Gary to find me. Well, no, that's actually not true. I think we knew each other before.
Yeah, we did.
And I told a little Vince Pesciotta story to the guys at KCUR last night at Chubby's on Broadway. I don't know if that'll make the cut, but I'm going to find that on the air and see. You know, I've waited at Chubby's on Broadway for over 10 years, and I've waited on the famous and the infamous.
Yeah, you have.
But
what's the most famous person you ever waited on?
The most famous person?
Yeah.
Tech Nine was one of them. I'm trying to think of the football player who hit a woman.
No, I don't know. There's been more than one of those,
right?
I think.
It wasn't Derek Thomas.
It wasn't Lenny Dawson.
No.
It wasn't Patrick Mahomes.
No, it wasn't anybody new. And I know like Jeremiah from the song Birthday Sex.
Yeah.
But probably Post Malone. You maybe don't know who Post Malone is. If you're younger... he's a kind of a white sort of white rapper
who was Vanilla
out.
Ice.
He was out on tour with Justin Bieber, opening for Justin Bieber at the Sprint Center, and the next morning after they did their show, he and like three of his entourage guys show up and order like $135 worth of food to go. And then, you know, it's like time to pay the bill. And all the entourage kind of steps to the side. His Post comes up with the credit card and a $200 tip.
Oh, cool. Wow.
Although that didn't go to me.
You got a piece of it.
I got a piece of the action. But here's the piece of the action that you want to get, ladies and gentlemen, because this is the plug before we finish the episode. And that is Gangland Wire is a podcast. 214 episodes that are free hanging out there. If you haven't been listening to them, you need to go back and listen to them because there's going to be so many. Now they're going to start disappearing again.
Yeah, I took some down. Some of the other ones, I took a few down. Nothing that I thought was important, but I took some down.
We're getting
too many out there.
And because there's so much to know, and Gary knows so much about the mob and Kansas City, he has an app called the Kansas City Mob Tour. For $1.99, you can take your own turn-by-turn tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. And then you still want to know more, so you want to get a good read? Get Gary's book, Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
And it's a great read, but it's a better listen because Gary's got a Kindle version with hyperlinks to video files that actually have the words spoken by the men that spoke them with a transcription. So you can understand what they're actually saying, but you can hear Tuffy DeLuna talk about the skim. And then there's so much more to know that you're going to want to come hang out with Gary Jenkins on November 23rd and 24th.
Or 24th and 25th. It's the Saturday and Sunday after Thanksgiving.
We need to make a note so we know the exact date every time we do this liner.
That's okay. It's a Saturday and Sunday after Thanksgiving at the Crown Center at the MTH Theater, starting about 1 o'clock. We'll show Gangland Wire. Then we'll have a panel discussion with myself and mob historian Terrence O'Malley and former retired FBI agent Bill Owsley, who has two books out there about the mob in Kansas City. Open City, The History of Organized Crime in Kansas City, and Mobsters in Our Midst, which tells about his career working on the mob. So Sunday, we'll have just the movies, and Terrence and I will both be there to do a Q&A after each of our movies. Go to my Facebook page and look for the event page, or go to my website and just Google Gangland Wire Film Festival, and I'll bet you'll find it.
Here, we've got folks joining us in the Facebook Live. I'd like to give a shout-out to Kenny Gallo, a.k.a. Kenji Gallo.
No, is Kenny on there?
Kenny's on there. He says, that's what you guys look like.
Yeah, that's what we look like.
Patrick Dobson.
Oh, hey, Patrick.
He says, I already want to hang out with Gary Jenkins.
Time we met for coffee. I just got a good report from your memoir writing seminar from a mutual friend of ours. Who else is on there? I know Sam Dawson was there and Ben's there and
Rick.
Rick was on earlier and Casey was on earlier, said he was coming back.
I'm just trying to pull them up. It says there might be a list here. It's in the watching now as I click on this over on the other side, and we'll give everybody a little shout out for watching. It just says watching now. Kenji Gallo, which you can find him. He's Kenny Gallo, G-A-L-L-O. So Kenji.
Christopher Williams, that's our Kansas City fan.
Who
has a Facebook page from Union Station and has one called On the Spot about Kansas City crime. You know, and back in the day, if they put you on the spot, that meant the mob was setting you up to kill you. David Breakspear, that's our English friend from, he has Omerita Social Club and several other, God, I'm trying to think of the names. He's got several mob Facebook pages. Just go in and run a search on Facebook for David Breakspear, and you'll find all the different mob pages that he's administrator on.
Well, you might go check out, look up Kenji Gallo. He's got a great book about his exploits, if you will.
He does. David Maxwell, I think he's a Canadian policeman, I think. Chris Matter, I don't know.
You know, there's a topic we've
John
never McDermott, really covered.
McDermott. Yeah,
we've never covered the Canadian mob, eh?
I know. They've got a whole mob family up there. We talked about them a little bit in the French Connection. Anyhow, we're trying to wind this thing down. Let's get out of here.
All right.
Say goodnight, Aaron.
Good night, Aaron.
Good night, everybody.
Bumper music provided by Odd O'Matic. Follow them on Twitter.
I've been all over the country, everywhere I could go. But while I lived in Las Vegas, I did them mostly in Las Vegas and Arizona.
And then I'm turning the pages, and then there was one additional page of notes here, and I'll read this the beginning of the copy here. It reads, "Hi, Gary. I tried to send the following message through the ganglandwire.com website contact form, but it returned an error, so I'm not sure if it went through or not. Anyway, here it is again."
Well, that's I don't know how that got on there. That's a whole different deal. That's nothing to do with any of this.
It says, "Hi, Gary, and hello, Aaron. I love the podcast."
Oh, well, good.
"Thanks for the information and entertainment."
Who was that guy?
"My grandfather grew up in the Kansas City area and lived here his entire life until his death approximately 2 years ago. He always claimed to have had slight connections with and some knowledge of KC organized crime activity. Growing up, we never really believed him or paid much attention, but he always seemed pretty serious about it. Just last week, though, I was digging through a bunch of stuff left at his estate and ran across a big stack of old credit cards, business cards, membership cards, and similar items that he had carried on his person here and there throughout his life. A bunch of them are business cards from little-known Casey area businesses that supposedly dealt in vending machines. Have you figured out who this is yet?
I can't remember his name. Yeah, I just responded to him, actually sent him some information.
I do know that not long after...
I don't think he says his name in there, does he? I can't remember. I asked at some point in time.
Not long after he got out of World War II, he worked for the well-known Vendo.
It's a company, big company, national company that made vending machines. He was involved in the vending machine business. He was asking about if the mob... His grandpa seemed to have some knowledge of and connection to the mob. He found a Tommy gun in his closet after he died or something. And something.
Well, he must have been in the mob then if he had a Tommy gun.
And actually, the local Kansas City mob was involved in the vending machine business. It was a big business for him back in the, right after the war, but probably started even before the war. Because it's, you know, every bar has a cigarette machine. Yeah. Every bar has a jukebox. So that's where they gravitate.
Anything that's all cash,
yeah, all cash,
and a vice in a way that something consumable like a cigarette, yeah. And of course they're probably boosting cigarettes to fill the machine.
Yeah, could be, buying those non-tax cigarettes, or go to another state where they have a low tax on cigarettes and they have a really high tax in Missouri and bringing them here and selling them without tax paying the Missouri state or the city's tax on them. So a variety of different scams can be had out of the vending machines.
Yeah. Here he says, he continues on, I jump a little ahead here. He always used to maintain that the mob was heavily involved in the vending industry. And knowledge of vending machines related businesses in the Kansas City area that have or had mob ties. And if so, would you be willing to share any information or possible discussion in your podcast? We might try to do an episode about...
Yeah, we could.
I mean, we've covered some stuff. I remember we had some criminals that went around to hotels and stripped the money out of the...
Stole the...
coins out
the
of
coin
the...
Coin machines,
coin machines. They got keys and they broke in floor to floor from the top to the bottom and they were gone.
10 floors of Coke machines that all have anywhere from, $50 to $100 in them. It can be a nice night with a really low... penalty. You just get caught breaking into a vending machine. Many times you walk away with a misdemeanor, city charge or something.
He continues on to say, as I mentioned, I do have several cards he carried over the years with business names, some of them quite esoteric and, weird. None of them except Vendo turned up in Google searches. As an odd side note, my grandfather had a Tommy gun in his closet when I was a young boy in the mid-70s through the 80s. And he says, email him. And maybe is his name Aaron as well?
Yeah, it is. I can't remember his last name.
Because I'm like, he's at the end, he has an email address. And he says, thanks! Aaron. Exclamation point, yeah. Aaron. And I'm like, well, you're welcome.